Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World, covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you here in The World's podcast feed. This last week, we took a look at misinformation about COVID-19 and how to curb it. Joining me was Dr. Vish Viswanath, professor of health communication at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Vish, I wanted to start, you know, earlier this month, the UN Secretary General denounced a, quote, pandemic of misinformation surrounding COVID-19. The World Health Organization has called out concerns about a, quote, infodemic, just a deluge of information and misinformation right now. There are, messages about miracle cures, conspiracy theories, racist speech, all happening right now. And so to start off, I wanted to ask about what is it that stands out for you right now? What sort of misinformation are you studying?
I think there are two types that we should distinguish. It's very important to distinguish between them. So one is misinformation, and some of it is unintentional. I think people are trying to make sense of the world, especially on an emerging infectious disease like this, where there is very limited knowledge and no treatment, no vaccination. So people are trying to make sense of it. And people are trying to understand and pass it on to their friends, people in their networks, information they think they have heard from someone else. And that is one type of information, which is not accurate, so we can call it and characterize it as misinformation. But I think Director General of WHO and others are referring to is active disinformation, where people are, intentionally peddling inaccurate information, and taking advantage of the situation. And there we are seeing two particular types. There are more types too, but two particular types stand out. One is the miracle cures. as you said. And this is not very new in the sense that we always had the so-called quote-unquote snake oil salesman. If you go back and look at advertising history, we always had people offering all kinds of peddling, all kinds of cures, miracle cures. I think, you know, this is kind of an extension of that. What is different here is that the scale at which you can do it and the speed, volume at which you can do it, right? So that's the difference, the big difference. But the second type of disinformation is the is certain social groups, ideologically driven groups, whether it is state actors or that is governments or non-state actors, actively spreading inaccurate falsehoods to sow seeds of doubt and division among people. So that's what we are seeing right now.
This is going to seem like a really basic question. And it sounds like, as someone that studies this communication, misinformation, I imagine you weren't surprised to see this, but why would there be these forces at play? Like, what is the motivation to seed disinformation?
So, you know, this is one of those pandemics. I think there are two, let me offer two propositions, I think, you know. So one, I have said this before, so I'm repeating what I said earlier. This is the first pandemic of the information age, of the social media age of its kind, you know, where, you know, within a very short span of time, 4 months, really, right? December, it was not so long ago. Within 4 months, we have seen the entire world ground to a halt in some ways. As I think, you know, that's what is so different about this, you know, because of the you know, that kind of a concentrate, you know, everything happening in a very concentrated period of time is what is shocking and what is causing or leading to this kind of a you know, explosion of this kind of information. So what's happening, in my view, the second proposition is that a group of people have seen an opening to further their own ideological agenda, whether it is anti-vaccine groups, whether it is pro-gun groups, whether it is right-wing anti-immigrant groups, or whether it is states or state actors, certain governments, who find it very convenient to, you know, to use this. So I think all these groups have found an opening, and some of them are collaborating. Maybe some of them are not necessarily collaborating, but it's a confluence of interest among them that is really leading them to come together to spread this information. One last point on this, Elena, is that I think. Unlike in other crises, we don't have a lot of answers. The answers are only evolving every day, right? Because the science is not settled. So that's even a bigger opening when people are hungry to make sense, you know, to help people make sense, you know, so, with this disinformation. So.
We are all hungering to make sense of it. And it sounds like it's really interesting to hear you contextualize this, and like, this is the first massive big spread of a contagious disease on a world level in this information age. So in light of that, you have a lab and a dashboard where you're trying to kind of monitor these things, but also provide some useful guidance for how to manage social media during this time. What are some ways that you advise people, or how you manage social media during this time, and how to use it, how to make sense of the information that's out there?
So the reason we created the dashboard is because, as I said, because the science is developing so fast, you know, usually when scientists publish papers, you know, nobody pays attention. You know, a few reviewers read it. Over a period of time, you know, people start paying attention. By the time the findings, results actually percolate to day-to-day practice, it takes years, if not decades. But unlike in the past, for this situation, everybody's very anxious about science. And every day, there is a new scientific finding, new paper that's been published. So what we found out is Because it's daily dose of science du jour, finding du jour, it's really confusing people, mm-hmm. right? This is the way science works, but people don't always understand that science takes a lot of time to develop that consensus. Here, the scrutiny is palpable every day, right there. The most public scrutiny of science that you have ever seen. So we realized right away in talking, in having conversations, that people started wondering how to make sense of this science and whether every new scientific finding is relevant to their day-to-day life. So that impelled us to say, okay, what is it that is relevant to me today to lead my life? What mm-hmm. science is relevant? And particularly those of us who focus on the underserved groups felt that this is really overwhelming when they're already dealing with unemployment, layoffs, furloughs, children being at home, to also wonder, to not really sift the chaff from the wheat, so to speak. So that's when we created this dashboard to make sense of the information, the day-to-day science, that the science that they need that day at that point in time and no more, number one. And in the process, we discovered social media contribute quite a bit, because this is the pandemic of the social media age in spreading this misinformation, disinformation, and information. So we were trying to make an attempt to somehow let people know why, if they are using social media, they have to be very careful about it. And that's the reason we suggested this mnemonic of think, essentially asking people to step back before you are trigger happy or finger happy and forward every message that comes to you. Can you step back a little bit and think about the source of this message? Is it really a credible information? Is it somebody you trust? Is it really going to be helpful to other people? When you buy a car, when you and I buy a car, we think about it carefully. We go out, we investigate, we ask people before we make the decision. But in somehow, in this case, there is, we are very eager to spread that information. That's what we were trying to do, just to make them think a little bit before they spread that information. Whether it works or not is a different issue, because I will be happy to talk about why it's not likely to work, or whether it is unfair to put the burden only on individuals, but certainly individuals have a role to play, I think.
You know, you mentioned some differences of what makes Now so different, and we are getting a lot of questions, and some of these are coming up in what you're talking about, but how, like, is this kind of misinformation, despite like the level and scale, how does it compare with COVID-19 to other recent outbreaks, whether it's H1N1? Or, you know, SARS from 2000.
Right. So number one, if you go back to H1N1 or SARS, they started in two different geographic regions, or MERS, you know, right? And then spread across the world. But the spread was less fast, less speedier, mm-hmm. number one. That's one. Number two, even if you take the latest one, which is MERS, you know, the penetration of social media was not as high compared to what it is today. Today, globally, people are on social media in one way or other, depends on what platform it is, but they're all on social media. So that's what makes a difference. The speed at which it spread, because it's a global world, we have heard that cliche before, it's a globalized economy. I think the speed and the penetration of media, social media, I think makes it different from other crises we have seen.
And it sounds like the uncertainty now makes it trickier, but the types of misinformation or disinformation do follow a similar trend of whether it's ideological groups or groups, and also then like the medical kind of miracle cure kind of, like that to you does seem to be a similar thread.
Yeah, so I think, a couple of points on that too, right? So this is what we call as emerging infectious disease. And it takes time, as you know, to understand the contours of the disease, why it's happening, what is happening, what are the consequences, how can we develop, how can we mitigate it, whether it's vaccination or treatment, etc. Here, we don't have a vaccine, we don't have treatment yet. but it is spreading very fast. The other thing that is contributing to this is I cannot think of an example right now where the entire economy has ground to a halt. Right? I don't think where 7 billion people in the world are paying attention to this one issue at right. one time and have been directly affected by it. Right? That's very unusual, I think. And that's mm-hmm. what makes it so different. You know?
So there are a lot of questions that are coming in, and I want to get to some real specifics. This one is from online, and the question begins that there was a recent study from researchers at Carnegie Mellon, and it found that half of the Twitter accounts spreading COVID-19 misinformation were actually bots. So what do we know about these kind of bots? Who's actually directing them? And what kind of information are they pushing? And on top of that, how are social media platforms responding?
This is a great question, because this is a question, we say these are great questions because we don't have good answers for them, right? So if you think about it, so the Carnegie Mellon study is one of the latest in this line of studies which are now emerging, whether it was our 2016 elections, but also in this context. The suspicion is that it is coming from state actors. They have not been able to completely confirm it, but they are suspecting that certain governments in the world are involved in actively spreading this information. Because the scale and the speed at which they are being produced, the volume and velocity, as we say in big data, at which these are being produced cannot be done by human beings. They can only be done by some kind of an algorithmic basis. So it is certain state actors who are engaging in this. That is a suspicion. At least that's what we are suspecting. Now, that's why I felt when I said, you know, I should, it is unfair to place the entire burden on people mm-hmm. on social media to say, don't be finger happy, restrain yourself. Because in my view, it is very difficult to put the entire burden and responsibility on people or individuals. In my view, something at this scale can be tackled only technologically and mm-hmm. institutionally. That's why social media platforms have a very important role to play. On this issue, I would give them mixed grades. You know, on the one hand, some of them at least are trying, right? When we pointed out the explicitly inaccurate anti-vaccine information, some social media platforms have made a decision to discourage that. Mm-hmm. But they are being very reactive in my view. So if the scale is of such kind, social media platforms should be more proactive on this thing, because it's only they who have the resources, the wherewithal, right? The technological and the institutional prowess to stem something like this. You and I can't do it. We can individually do everything we can or try restrain ourselves. But at the scale at which this is happening, social media platforms have to come forward. So far, my feeling is that they have been very reactive. They act only when they have been pointed out, like the Plandemic movie, documentary, whatever you want to call it, you know, that was spreading around, and they have been told their attention has to be drawn to it. I think that's very difficult. How many think tanks, how many groups can continue to monitor and do this? So I think it is the role of the social media platforms to be much more aggressive and much more proactive on this.
You know, you mentioned anti-vax movements, and that leads to another question. Which ties into the earlier conversation about, you know, certain ideological groups or certain things that have been present before this pandemic. But this question from online is that before COVID-19, groups like the anti-vax movement have social media networks for disseminating information that's skeptical of doctors, of pharmaceuticals, and often promoting this value of like natural immunity. So is there a relationship between this movement and ideas and the misinformation now that's spreading around COVID-19? So getting a little bit more specific.
Yeah, I think what is different in this situation is the anti-vaccine groups always had social media networks of their own, and they have posted them. In some cases, they have been able to reach beyond their own immediate network. So that by itself is not new, I think. In my view, what is new is finding that common cause, right? So there are a lot of groups who are protesting the lockdowns, the shelter at home advisories, etc., right? For a variety of reasons. So a number of these groups, whether it is an anti-immigrant group, whether it is a pro-gun group, whether it is a particularly ideologically driven group, as I said earlier, I think what is happening is they have found a common enemy, that is the state, the government, and that common enemy is, so it's kind of a, the phrase I used is confluence of interests. And I think they are finding that common ground among each other, whether intentionally or unintentionally, deliberately or not deliberately, attacking this state government, government actors. And that's what is different, I think, in this time around. Particularly, if you think about it, we are talking a lot about vaccines, right? Again, we always talk a little bit about immunization, and we would talk about vaccines when there is an outbreak of measles somewhere. But right now, everybody is waiting with a bated breath on a vaccine, right? People are receptive in the right type of mind. This is a good time also to talk about bad things, right?
Mm-hmm. So in terms of talking about bad things, I wonder about this question that came from online, the lessons around communication having to do, with climate change. This question point is that it's beginning to remind me of the debate around climate change, what we're looking at with COVID-19. And there's broad scientific consensus, for example, but a lot of political polarization around it. So what can we learn from that?
You know, it's a really interesting analogy. I've been thinking about this too, right? So there is science and there is politics.
Mm-hmm.
In general, they have run parallel to each other. Though it is somewhat naive to think scientists are apolitical or all science is non-political, let me put it that way. And certainly there has always been some intersection and overlap, but in general, those two have moved in parallel, I think. Climate change is one where they are now conflated with each other, right? There is a great overlap. And there is a lot of consensus on climate change among scientists, but it has become quote unquote politicized, and that's what is happening with this. And my feeling, and again, I don't have empirical evidence, but what is happening in both places, I think, there are similarities and differences. The similarities are that the recommendations stemming from climate change science or the recommendations stemming from COVID-19 will have a direct impact on people, right? So for example, you might say, I might want to increase carbon tax, right? That has a direct impact on people. You might want to reduce, fossil fuels consumption. That has a direct impact on people. And economy. It's the same thing with COVID-19. The difference is that we don't have a consensus on why, or the science, we are still developing the consensus, but the impact is immediate, if you see it, right? When your business closes, yeah, I'm out of a job right away. And so therefore, I think there is that interaction is very quick and immediate, unlike in other crises. And that's what is happening here. I think whether it is in climate change, and there are people who have done a lot of thinking, so I should be very careful in what I say, or in this case, we have to develop that consensus around what actions are necessary and what actions are not necessary. If I may, let me say this particular crisis is a good example. It calls for global leadership. Mm. If you think about it, if you are going to take or make decisions that's going to affect the livelihood of 7 billion people directly or indirectly, no part of the world is immune from it, directly or indirectly. This calls for a global leadership where leaders could come together and make certain decisions. Even if they don't agree with all the decisions, at least there is some kind of a consensus. The lack of consensus, you know, is what is, you know, I think, you know, causing all the problems now.
I just want to take a moment to remind viewers and listeners that this is a Facebook Live conversation with Vish Viswanath, and I'm Alana Gordon, and you can post and add your questions to the conversation. We want to hear from you too. So this is a follow-up question from Paul. Is it reasonable then for state actors like the US or EU to build algorithms or authorized bots to spread valid information or reply to the disinformation bots? So that's a question about bots, but I have a follow-up question about the broader leadership questions.
It would be very easy for me to say the state actors should start building bots, but I can easily immediately run into issues because of the value systems of each country, right? You know, I think if you are in the US, immediately we have certain rules. First Amendment does not allow the state to play a very active role, and you can immediately see a lot of people being threatened by it. In the same way that, we have to have some degree of caution in asking platforms to go in and intervene very aggressively, because then it raises issues of censorship, So I think there is appropriate degree of caution. On the other hand, there are states, there are countries where it is perfectly acceptable for state governments or governments to go in and do certain things. It's a very difficult question in that sense. My response would be that powerful actors with institutional resources should come together to develop that consensus and say, to define this is a danger, this is a threat, and we have to act in concert with each other, especially when you see a threat like this. We have done that before. When we see a hurricane, state actors come together with private actors to take actions. So if we are seeing this global threat, I think it is perfectly reasonable for them to come together to do that. You know?
This question comes from online, kind of taking it flip back to people in the midst of this. The science is changing so quickly, or we're in an age of a lot of preprints and all sorts of things. It's hard to keep up, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of the changing information, making it more difficult to root out. This question is, does that speed make it difficult? And then with that, how do you manage that? How do you find and suss out the information that is helpful and truthful?
Yeah, I think the as I said earlier, it takes years for science or findings or results from science to percolate to day-to-day practice, as in decades or at least a couple of years, and that has inbuilt filters and processes every step of the way, right? The peer review process of fellow scientists looking at your studies and determining whether those studies are worth publishing or not. Then there are standard journalism practices. Most journalists have certain rules, professional practices, which allow them to decide or at least use some decision rules to judge whether it is worth publishing or not, right? And all that helps in putting out papers in general, not always, in general, science that is more consensus oriented, with some, of course, there are exceptions. I do see a problem with the way science is happening now. The problem stems from the fact that it is happening every day. Every day we are publishing dozens of papers all over the world. We do not know the extent to which they are undergoing rigorous review by fellow scientists because we are so anxious to know about this. And I must say, we will be wrong. Others have said it. It's not an original thought. Others have said it. We are more likely to be wrong. What we published in February, we may be saying in April, but we are wrong when we published it. And that is the nature of science. Science always contests internally and disproves findings. That's previous studies. But the problem is this is also public. And that is what is making it difficult to manage. So what are the solutions for this? I don't think there is an easy solution. It's not easy. We need consensus. It doesn't help when political actors contradict science so openly and start peddling wrong scientific information. Right? That makes it even more difficult. I keep going back to this notion of consensus. I'm not naive, right? I'm not that naive. But what I'm saying is at more than at any other time, given the magnitude of the decision-making that is taking place, you know, we need actors, state, private sector, government, scientific sector to come together to make some of these decisions to say what is needed, what is the science we have, what is needed, what is the best way to use that science in policy. I think it is happening in an environment where there is already a greater divisiveness, greater distrust, and that is what is making it difficult.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of politicization of studies and numbers and statistics based on these huge pressures, whether it's opening the economy or other things. Regina was asking about this online, about like who's, when it comes to all the peer reviews and everything else, there are these conversations that happen within scientists, and now we have the public weighing in, politicians, but whose responsibility is it to monitor this sort of thing? I know you mentioned like there has to be consensus in actors, but is it the university? Is it peer commentaries? Like, how do you see that translation?
Yeah, so there are two sides to this, right? It's amazing, just like our frontline healthcare workers who are working day in and day out, there are scientists who are doing incredible work, right? I mean, they are working under tremendous pressure. It's also great that they are getting a lot of attention,
and you including social scientists. You can't wait 2 years right now to
Absolutely.
Start sharing that information.
Absolutely. And they're working, and they're sincerely working hard to get it out as quickly as possible with all great intentions. However, I think that comes with certain responsibility, and this is where I think institutions that are consumers of science, right, in the governments, for example, have a responsibility to say, okay, the scientists are going to do what we are asking them to do. What is our job in interpreting these signs, right? The so-called knowledge brokers, right? Are the policymakers scientifically literate enough to take this science that is being published and say, what kind of steps can we take based on what we know today, because we can't afford to wait. But the other thing I want to add to this is you cannot make the decision on your own. You have to bring other powerful people along with you, right? And explain it to people. I have always argued in public communication, transparency is very critical, which means you have to get up there, bring people along with you, including other sectors. Otherwise, you know, you'll continue to have people suspect your motives.
We are getting ready to wrap up, and there are so many questions and follow-up questions from here that I hope we can continue. But I want to get to this one. It comes from online. The question is, I'm confronted with false information that I see about COVID-19, is it better to try to refute it or ignore it? If I try to refute someone to a conspiracy theory out there, I'm worried I may just be bringing more attention to it.
Actually, there is interesting scientific support for that argument. The refutation doesn't always work, you know, because when you refute, you have to repeat, number one, the falsehood, and then you refute it. So by sheer repetition of that falsehood will leave people at least some memory trace, right? You know, okay, so there seems to be, when it is especially repeated, so people over time forget the details and they will remember that vague connection between those two things. So it's a great question. I think contestation, you don't want falsehoods to be kept, go uncontested. But I think there is an emerging consensus on how to refute it in a very thoughtful, careful way so that you don't repeat the falsehood, making sure that the facts are salient out there before you repeat the myths, I think, or the falsehood. That may be one way to do that.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, before we do wrap up, and maybe there's a way tactfully to talk about this without creating a sort of belief echo, but what is the biggest lie you've seen out there about COVID-19?
It depends on what country you are in and what platform you are in. And this worries me, I think one of the falsehoods I'm seeing is this, around how the virus itself emerged. And we will have an investigation at some point. We will learn how exactly it jumped from the bats to animals. We will know eventually. We may not, but we may know. But the other component of that is worrisome. That's kind of a bigotry that it is fostering, right? Mm-hmm. So certain groups, certain countries, certain people are responsible for it, for spreading it. And that's one of the things that has really, one of the biggest falsehoods I have seen. Hmm. The other falsehood is this kind of a peddling of miracle cures. The interesting point about this is we are worried not about those who peddle or those who believe in it. You cannot change their mind, But it is this fence sitter, so to speak. It is this middle group of people who don't have a lot of time to pay attention to every falsehood out there, who are busy with their own lives, right? It is those people, that could be particularly susceptible, right? If it is continues to be repeated. And this kind of, especially when they are trying to make sense of this. Mm-hmm. And so this peddling of this miracle cures, I think, is having some, as you have been reading, some serious consequences on the health of the people. I think those are the two big baskets of, falsehoods I've been seeing, that worry me.
Has it surprised you?
What surprises me is the velocity or the scale and the speed at which it is happening. There are real issues that one should worry about. Hundreds of millions of poor people are out of jobs, are struggling every day, trying to make sense of it, trying to live through their lives. Those issues are not coming out. There are certain groups which are disproportionately affected by this crisis. Those are not coming out. What is coming out, what is being paid more attention to, are these kinds of falsehoods. Especially the scale surprises me. I think the speed, not the falsehoods themselves.
Well, Vish, thank you so much for this conversation and for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Vish Viswanath, professor of health communication at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. From PRX.